Good morning and welcome to Family Life, your host, Salima Muhammad and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent Murad Speech. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. I greet the listening audience in the peace of Assalam Alaikum. This week's discussion, Family Life, we are so pleased and honored to have the guest, Sheikh Muhammad Ibn Hisham Zabir. Sheikh Muhammad Ibn Hisham Zabir is a forensic historian with a special interest in Islamic, African, and American history. He is the son of the late Hajj Hisham Zabir, who performed the final funeral rites of Malcolm X, Al-Hajj al-Malik Shabazz. As one of the eldest remaining members of the AAUAA, which is the oldest chartered Orthodox Islamic organization in America dating to the 1930s. Muhammad Jabir has witnessed firsthand much of the history and evolution of Islam in America unfold. He is a lifetime student of knowledge with more than 50 years of combined research, training, and practical experience in Arabic, Islamic studies, history, leadership, and dawah. He is the author of Call Me Muslim and the director of many historical forums such as 75 Years of Islam, Muslims of the African Diaspora, Children of Ibrahim Lost in History, and From Malcolm X to Al-Hajj al-Malik Shabazz. He is a graduate of the 1978 Muhammad bin Saud Imam Training Seminary in Naperville, Illinois. Muhammad Jabir is also a graduate of Arabic Language Institute of Fez, Morocco, and Jannatul Mawwa of Cairo, Egypt. Currently holding a BA in Arabic Language Systems. Formerly, he served as the imam for Muslim communities in New Jersey, North Carolina, and New York, as well as host for the WBIMA Muslim Talk Radio. Currently, Muhammad Ibn Hisham Zabir is the executive director of BIMA, Bureau of Indigenous Muslim Affairs Incorporated. Sheikh Muhammad Ibn Hisham Zabir, welcome to Blog Talk Radio Family Life.
Thank you. I'm very honored and pleased to be here today.
What a history, what a background. Forensic historian, let us begin with a discussion on Islam in North America. And if you can explain that evolution, we would be most grateful.
Alhamdulillah, I like to say assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you all, and I would like to thank this network for inviting me. I'm very honored, and hopefully that we can benefit each other through the course of our discussion and interview. The question of the evolution of Islam in America is a very profound question, and it deserves a profound answer. I begin by saying that Islam has always been in America. Islam preceded the slave ships, when it came by way of the Spanish ships, when the fall of Andalus in 1492, Muslims were scattered out in the Caribbean and the South American regions. And we know that it was a mandate that all the Muslims who came from Andalusia, and when I'm talking about Andalusia, I'm talking about the Moors from North Africa, West Africa, and the Arabs who made the migration through Africa, Egypt, and ended up in Andalusia with a conquest with Tariq bin Ziyad, and they reigned power for about 800 years. And in 1492, they lost that station, and they were actually placed on Spanish ships, and they was sent to the New World, what we call the New World today, the Americas. However, they were forced to denounce their religion, and they became known as Moriscos, which is Muslims who have converted to Christianity. And as we know, as generations developed, the light of Islam went out. And there was a second wave with the people of the African diaspora who came here in the slave ships. Many of them, some historians estimate at least 30-40% of the slaves who came into the Americas, and I'm talking about the mainland, the United States as we know it today, were Muslims. And we have some highlights of certain personalities who survived in the literary context, such as Omar Said, Yarmouth Mahmoud, Solomon Joby, and so forth and so on. However, there was many Muslims, you know, not forgetting about Abdurrahman, the prince among slaves. There were many Muslims who were actually captive or held captive in the slave colonies. However, their life, their experience did not make it into the literary world. But there were Muslims here. Unfortunately, after generations, the light of Islam went out again, which brought about a real struggle. You know, some of the things that we have to really admit that there were Muslims who came here from the Levant in the 1800s. You know, they came by way of the Ottoman Empire, such as the Turkish provinces, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, so forth and so on. But they didn't come into the country as Muslims because of the racial climate that was going on at that time in America. They came in as whites. And with the anti-miscegenation laws, with the segregation laws that was actually state-supported, these Muslims classified themselves as whites. And they themselves assimilated in the white culture, and they did not go forth to try to propagate their Islam to people of color because it would have interfered with their status. And by default, we had early organizations such as the Moorish Science Temple. They began to evolve with Noble Drew Ali having the philosophy of Islam, not necessarily the theology or the practice, but actually knowing historically that many of the slaves that had come into America were of the Moorish Empire. And he himself identified with that paradigm, and that was the level of his Islam. And they knew Allah was the God. They knew that Mecca was this our holy sanctuary, and they knew about the Prophet Muhammad. However, they did not have the literary text of the Quran to give them the type of guidance. Being that they were people of color. Drew Ali himself is of African descent and Native American, which rendered him as a person of color, which created racial barriers wherein he could not assimilate or integrate with the Muslims from the Muslim world. So that is a very early presence. A lot of people may pose criticism for the Moorish Science Temple and their evolution, but they are unaware that they did not have the full package of Islam. They were groping in the dark, trying to grasp onto the reality of Islam. And we have to give them credit because that is the root, that is the foundation in which we grew out of, you know, as a community until we reached our full fruition. And to make it a long story short, so we can get to the next question. Now, something that is unique about the Moorish Science Temple, they took root in Chicago and also Detroit. And Durrani started his mission in Newark, New Jersey. It was actually the Canaanite Temple. It had a lot of the Masonic elements in it, you know, because within the Masonic order, they are elements of Islam that's concealed, because they had to conceal it at that particular time. In many states, you know, many plantations, if your Islam was pronounced, then there was reprisals and there was actually some real repercussions that you would have to endure for actually saying that you was a Muslim. So the Prince Hall Masonic Order was one base in which Juwali was able to reach deeper than the religion of Christianity, because, you know, the order of the Masonics is that they reach deeper than, you know, the Christian faith. And from that, he began to search for his Islam. And we're talking about in the early 20s, you know, early 20s. And he made a migration to Chicago and Detroit, and they set up two major temples there. And if you look at the timeline and the growth of Islam, we see that everyone walked that path. You know, Detroit and Chicago was very unique. Temple number 7 was in Chicago, and temple number 2 was in Detroit. Now, there's a very unique personality that was affiliated with Noble Durrani. And Noble Durrani was from North Carolina. And there's a person whose name at that time was Lomax Bay. He was from Greenville, South Carolina. It's amazing how the people from the South, you know, was more profound in bringing forth, you know, social justice. They came to the front line. And for some reason, it's just maybe they was nurtured in an environment where the injustice was just so apparent that they had to come forth and speak against that. Even, you know, Elijah Muhammad come from the South, you know, and Juwali coming from the South, and Lomax Bay coming from the South. Mm-hmm. Lomax Bay himself, and I speak of that line because I am a recipient of that growth. Lomax Bay was second in charge to Noble Durrani. He managed, in fact, he was the governor of the temple in Detroit. In about 1927, Noble Durrani announced that he was a prophet, and that and he introduced the Circle 7, what we call the Circle 7 Quran, which actually is more so a plagiarized version of the Quranic gospel. And he introduced that. And what is so unique about the early struggles of people of color, especially those who are descendants of ex-slaves and by way of the African diaspora, they was looking for a different expression than the Christian religion, not because of the religion itself, but because of the slave masters had embraced Christianity and they had interpreted Christianity in a way that it subjected one type of people, and that was the people of color, and they was trying to find another platform to address their social injustice. And Islam, which removed the color bar, which removes this status, colorism, and so forth and so on, seemed to be the best tool. And also, they had historical connections to that, based on their ancestors coming out of a Muslim land and so forth. So they gravitated towards that. And as I mentioned, sister, they did not have the full package. When Noble Durrani introduced the Circle 7 and made his pronouncement that he was a prophet, Lomax Bay, which was his second in charge, defected from that, you know. And, you know, when we look at, when I say defected, I don't mean in a negative sense, because sometimes, you know, there's positive defecting, you know, even though at that very moment it may appear to be negative, but that's a growth process. And as a result of that, you know, they split, and Professor Ezzedine, which was Lomax Bay, he traveled to Turkey, okay, and we're talking about in the 1920s. You know, early 30s. It's very unique to look at that, because if you look at Jim Crow South and the type of treatment, you know, that people of color were receiving, it did not appear that there would be any hope for us in America. And that's why Marcus Garvey, which is actually the first black hero, you know, came forth with the philosophy of Pan-Africanism, meaning that we have to return back to our homeland because there was no way that they could see justice in this land. And that's why Professor Ezzedine, which was Lomax Bey at that time, went to Turkey looking for refuge. One thing that is unique about that transition or that migration, which is recorded not only in the American papers, but also in the Turkish papers about his travels. They went in not as Moors, they went in as Muslims. And the paper cited them as Negro Muslims, you see? So showing you that there was a very early presence of Islamic consciousness, you know, in our people. You know, it was more philosophical than it was theological because they didn't have all the food. And that is where Islam took its root. Turkey itself has suffered tremendously by being, you know, an ally to the left side during World War I, and they were trying to put their pieces together. And Professor Ezzedine went to Turkey, and he tried to find a stability there. However, they end up being in the lot of poverty. Their condition there seems to be worse than they were facing in America in regards to resources. So eventually the people lost hope, you know, and they ended up in despair, and they began to trickle out in various parts of the Muslim world, and some of them returned to America. Professor Ezzedine Muhammad, he went to Egypt, okay, and he studied 5 years at Al-Azhar University. And for the 5 years, he came back to America, and he did not have any intentions of coming back. It's just that the student revolution in Egypt started at that particular time. Being that he was an Egyptian citizen, you know, he didn't have the necessary protections, you know. So he came back as a safety net. And he came back and he established the AAUAA, the Adinu Alahi Universal Arabic Association, which is the first indigenous Sunni organization in America, indigenous, that was established in 1936. And from that, you know, they began to organize all the different pseudo-Islamic groups, tried to create a sense of unity and cooperation, and from that, the other organizations began to grow out of that. So I think, you know, we can go to a specific question as to what I discussed so far so that we can bring a little bit more clarity to our audience.
Oh, yes, and I have several. So let's start here, because you mentioned Turkey, you mentioned, you know, different Egypt, different parts of the world. Let's go back to the very beginning. Let's go to the revelation on to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace be upon him. How that message expanded throughout the world. And then I want to come back to some specifics here, starting with, you know, the early 20s and going into the 30s. But before we do that, let's talk about how the message of the prophet expanded throughout the world and maybe, say, landed in America.
Great. Great question. You know, and you'd always say, sister, that they have to hate you before they love you. And What I mean by that is that, you know, the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing be upon him, was born in a society where people were in a state of what we call jahiliyyah, a state of ignorance, meaning that it doesn't mean that they didn't know how to manage their affairs, but it means that they didn't have any divine guidance, that they would actually decide, you know, what to do with their lives, how to live their lives, and judge based on their own whims. They did not have divine guidance, and it's almost like, you know, letting children play, you know, on the curb. If they don't have the proper guidance, eventually they're going to step off the curb in the way of a car, and then we're going to have a tragedy. And that's what had happened to Arabia. They began to fall below what we call the human moral standards. They were burying their children alive. There was no real institutions of marriage. It was shifting. You know, they didn't have a dietary regulations, and they was wayward. They was definitely without guidance. When other nations was very much civilized, you know, we had the remnants of the Roman Empire, We have the Persian Empire. We have the Abyssinian Empire, which was advanced societies at that particular time. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Almighty, chose Muhammad. And we know that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he makes examples, you know, for us to, you know, to look at. You know, he always looked at the downtrodden, the rejected, and he raised them into power, just as he did the children of Israel when they was in Egypt, subjected to the oppression of the Pharaoh, that he raised up Moses from the slave culture and brought about a total liberation for that people. And we see that in the life of the prophet. And we, but the difference is the prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he went to his own people, you know, who had the echo of the oneness of God, you know, from our patriarch Abraham. So it was a manifest deviation that they could recognize. However, their desires for the better life, which actually included exploiting, you know, a segment of their society, blind them from the truth. And he was forced out of his society, you know. They pushed him out, you know, threatened his life. And many of his early followers lost their lives, and many of them had to go to other societies to seek refuge. One of that early migration was into Abyssinia, you know, when he sent his cousin Jafar as his representative to speak to the Najasi, the king of Ethiopia. And the prophet addressed him as a king, as a ruler, as a just ruler, and in Africa. Islam went to Africa before it went to Asia or Europe or any other part of the world. And many of them took up root. They didn't return. And there was a second migration. What is unique about the Ethiopian community and the Arabian community is that they share the same grandmother, Hagar. You know, so they had their blood intermingled. Ethiopia ruled southern Arabia for 400 years. Okay, when we see during the time of the prophet, we see Ethiopian in captivity as slaves, not because that they were a weak people, it's just because they lost the war. In fact, there was more Arabs enslaved than they were Ethiopians. So this is something, you know, history has avoided to show the prominence and the power of the great Abyssinian Empire and how they contributed not only to the culture but also to the linguistics of the Arabic language, you know. So so they are sister countries. And so the prophet felt very comfortable sending his people to a neighbor who had tires. Okay, Amr bin As, when he went into Egypt, for the what we call the conquest of Egypt. And a lot of times, unfortunately, sister, we see the presence of Islam and the Arab presence in Egypt. We are under the impression that the Arabs conquered the Africans, but Egypt had been ruled by foreigners for over 1,000 years. And when the Muslims went into Egypt, it wasn't just Arabs. It was Persians. It was Romans. It was Ethiopians that was in that cadre. And Egypt at that time was being governed and ruled by the Romans. And Saint Benjamin, who was an indigenous Egyptian, told the Coptics to join the Muslims against the Romans because the Muslims would give them more justice. So the Romans was repelled. And when Amr bin As gained the conquest, he told Saint Benjamin, who was a Coptic, you know, indigenous Egyptian, that your people would not have to pay any jizya, any types of security tax. We will give you funds to repair your religious institutions, okay? And, but for the Romans, they have three choices. They have to either become Muslim or they pay the jizya, which is a protective tax, or they can go back to their country. So you see that relationship with Africa and Arabia in the very early stages of Islam. There was no hostile wars fought inside of Africa, especially West Africa. Islam went in by trade. It went in by teachers and scholars and things of that nature, taking root, intermarrying with indigenous tribes there, sharing their blood. In fact, Timbuktu is a conglomeration of African tribes and Arab tribes coming in, Mansa Musa bringing about 7,000 scholars from Mecca to see that particular region. So we have to look at the concept Arabia. That's why when you go back and read some of the classic texts of the Nation of Islam, it talks about the tribe of Shabazz coming out of Mecca, you see, and talking about the original Arabs and then who they were and so forth, that the Arabs and the African was indistinguishable in their phenology. It's just the politics that have separated us and the bloodlines and so forth and so on. But showing that Islam, you know, Africa was the heartbeat of Islam. That is the actual growth. The Ja'alani tribe, which was in southern Yemen, now they are situated in Sudan. Most of the Sudanese Arab tribes come from southern Yemen. When they went there, they saw a better, what we call it, land for cultivation, and it had rivers and things of that nature. So they settled there. 80,000 plus went there from one tribe and settled in that particular region called the Sudan today. The concept of Africa and Arabia did not exist as two separate entities at that particular time. It was more tribal. Like I say, we talk about the tribe of Shabazz and all of these, you know, the tribes that went into Africa. But a lot of people lost this history because the British refused to record our history. If you want to find out really who we were as a people, as an ancient people, you have to go to the Greek and Roman texts, okay? Because the British, in their agenda, was to demise and to subjugate a people. So in order to subjugate a people, you have to deprive them of their royal history, in which they did. And we are victims of that today, and that's why we are groping in the dark and trying to find out who we are, because we don't know who we were. So Islam entered into Africa, and many of the prophets, and I visit a lot of the prophets' descendants, his progeny, graves when I was in Morocco. You know, a lot of them went into that particular region. Many of them are in the in Egypt, and also in Ethiopia. You know, he has blood ties there. In fact, many of the people possibly that came by way of the slave states probably are descendants of the companions, because many of them had children inside of the African continent and so forth and so on. So I'm saying that to say that there's no real definitive lines to separate the people on the continent of Africa and those first Arabs who made that migration across. What we're looking at now is people coming from the north, you know, Persia, coming from, you know, Greece, Turkey, and places like that, and it has given us a distorted image of who were the indigenous people of those lands, and historians have not been just to make that clarification.
You know, you bring up some good points here. So following the history, they always say follow the money. You made a good point. You made a very good point about how history is not transcended and how you cannot find exact histories under certain titles. And even slavery, you know, I tell people often, slavery, if you go look, even today, if you want to know or understand the full concept of the slave trade, you're not going to find it under slavery. You're going to find it under mercantilism. Mercantile. That's the money that was behind the slave trade. You mentioned politics. That was the politics behind the slave trade. You mentioned Timbuktu. Can you talk about, because we're going to go into your experience in Morocco in a few minutes, but can you talk about Timbuktu and the Mali Empire and how Islam was influenced?
Wow. You know, I always consider Timbuktu the third seat of Islamic scholarship. Okay. We know that Medina was the first, and then if we consider Iraq and then Damascus, yes, but they're one and the same. The real scholarship of the African continent was in Timbuktu. Timbuktu was not just a monolithic society; it was a diverse society. Okay, it was a city that not only Muslims came in to study, it was non-Muslims who came in to study. And they did not only deal with the Islamic sciences, they also dealt with secular sciences, you know. It was a city that attracted the best minds, you know, and it's Timbuktu at that particular time was called Western Sudan. In fact, my great-grandfather, Grandpa Matt, he was actually captured, you know, as a youth. okay, and brought into the Americas as a slave. And he came from Mali at that time. And that's why a lot of times in my CV, you may see that I have Sudanese affinity, and that's because of my great-grandfather, Grandpa Mal. And anytime we use the term Mali, the slave owners would say the Mali man. Mali and Guinea actually was synonymous to Muslims, okay, because the Muslims came from a certain region. So if we look at, if we can connect the dots, you know, and look at these terms and names, we will actually be able to identify the people that were there. We have over 600,000 documents that were recorded in Arabic, and they used the Arabic script to write in Timbuktu. They was very literate. You know, anytime you find a society that can actually record, you know, mathematics, calculus, astronomy, not astrology, but astronomy, in Arabic, horticulture, you know, medicine in Arabic language, they have to be very proficient in the language, okay, meaning that the Arabic language had become the lingua franca in that particular region. It was the universal language of knowledge. So people had to learn the Arabic language. And also the people of Mali used the Arabic script to record books in their native tongue. So every time you see a Malian manuscript, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an Arabic narrative. It could also be in a native or tribal language there, but they use the Arabic alphabet. Mali was you know, to get a captive from Mali, you know, was actually getting the choices of the slaves because they were educated, you know. Mm-hmm. And one reason why we lost contact with the Muslim population in America is because the Muslim was so highly educated in many areas that they was assimilated, you know, into the white culture, okay, meaning that they had a different status, you know, by default, you know, that they were so precious that the masters would actually protect them from any harm until they could abstract from them all the knowledge that they had. And that was a very unique area with inside of Africa. We know Mansa Musa was from Mali, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of the misnomers that we have is that a lot of times we find people saying, well, you know, the Arabs went in and they conquered us in Africa, or they conquered the African tribe. But a conqueror, he'll carry his name. If you look at the kings and rulers of the Muslim Empire, from the Songhai Empire to the Malian Empire, these were the indigenous people ruling. So that's no conquest. Mansa Musa come from a line of rulers. And after him, he was preceded by rulers. Look at Sunni Ali, Ali, Askia Muhammad. Yes. All of these were indigenous people in that land. So there's no conquest. You understand?
Yes.
So we see that these people maintain their own autonomy. And as Islam began to influence the society, not only did it become the theological expression of the people, but they began to instill the culture, you know, inside of their culture. So you find in Mali, it is a mixture. You know, that is a very Afro-Arab admixture there, not only with knowledge, but its expression, phenology, bloodline, and so forth and so on. So it's a very rich society. Now, I consider it the third seat of Islamic knowledge and scholarship. And unfortunately, today, we have not done enough work to do translations on those documents to make them available to the world. And just about 5 to 6 years ago, we heard there was a mass burning and destruction of those literary works. And I don't think it's a coincidence. Yes. I think that there's so much in those documents that's untranslated that would actually reintroduce to the world a different lens as to how we should see the African empires.
Yes, sir. Oh, thank you. That was just superb. To the listening audience, this program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Murad Speaks. Sheikh Tabir, you're a graduate of the Arabic Language Institute of Fez. Explain that experience in your first travel experience overseas. You've been to Morocco, Egypt, etc. explain that experience.
Yes. My first travels was as a young, I was in Saudi Arabia. I lived in Mecca for some time, not as a student, but as a just as a guest, you know, just absorbing the culture. In fact, I lived on a street called Jabal al-Kaaba, which was about maybe 8 minutes walk from the sacred mosque in Mecca. And it's amazing that every prayer I made during my stay there was in the Haram. There was no other places that I prayed except the Haram, the sacred mosque in Mecca. That was a good experience. And I, you know, when I go to Mecca, when I went to Mecca, and I first saw the Kaaba, you know, this is like the center of the world. It's like where time stands still. And I had an epiphany, and I could identify with El-Hajj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X, when he actually went to Mecca. It's a transcending experience, you know. I mean, it's something unexplainable. There's no words that can capture that uniqueness, that phenomenon, you know, of seeing humanity, you know. It's almost like the beginning and the end of creation all meshed in one. So that was my experience there. And it's a place that where, you know, you don't have future aspirations and your past doesn't haunt you. It's like if you could just stay in that moment forever, you would be satisfied. That was my experience when I made the first pilgrimage to Mecca in 1980. I was a youngster at that particular time. I grew up, you know, in an Islamic environment. I'm a second-generation Muslim. And, you know, sometimes that amazes me because when I see people convert to Islam or revert to Islam, I'm really excited, you know, because they have something to compare to. They have something to reflect on and what they come out of, you know, and they can see a growth and improvement. But, you know, I don't have anything to compare my life with. I'm a first-generation Muslim. You know, that's all I know, you know, my habits, my reflections, you know, my thoughts, everything, you know. If you threw me off a building, I wouldn't say, oh, Jesus. I would say Allahu Akbar. I don't have anything else in my resume but a Muslim. And so my early orientation, you know, I grew up in the Muslim community. We had the Ezzedine Village in Hampton, New Jersey. You know, we was learning the sciences of Islam as children. We was learning the Arabic language as children. So I wanted to expand, you know, my experience, you know. So Morocco, I have on my mother's side, we have Moroccan roots, so forth and so on. And I just wanted to go to Morocco for a visit, you know, and my father encouraged me to go, and I traveled to Morocco, and it was a very, very rich historical country. I mean, they have, relics that's, you know, 1,000 years old, you know, just such amazing history when you talk about Islam and how the Muslims is able to navigate, you know, in the modern world. And what happened was I didn't go with the intention of being a student. I went to actually tour the country. And I actually toured the country. I went to all the major states and so forth. And when I got to Fez, you know, I found out that Fez was actually one of the cities or centers of learning. And we had one of the oldest, if not the oldest, Islamic institutions there called Jamiat al-Qadawiyyin, and university that was actually founded by two women. So I enrolled in the Arabic Language Institute there, and I also attended the university for classes, you know, in the traditional manner, where you go in, you got the scholar sitting in the chair, and you sit, you know, in the masjid on the floor, and you have different departments in that university. Maybe here they're teaching the Arabic language, the science of the Arabic language. Here they're teaching fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence. Here they're teaching the commentary of Quran. Here they're teaching the history of the Prophet, the seal of the Prophet, so forth and so on. So you have different, inside of one huge masjid, you may have 7-8 different classes going on at one time. So I took advantage of that as I studied the Arabic language in the institute, it's called ADIF, the Arabic Language Institute of Fez. I also attended the university. It was actually in the same precinct, so it wasn't a hardship for me to get there every day. And I went to the old city, and I spent most of my time, you know, talking to some of the elders about, you know, their experience as Muslims and so forth. So it was a very good experience, to the point, sister, that when I came back, I was so inspired that I asked my father, could I actually take up permanent residence there? And at that time, he had established what we called the Jihadi Institute. It was an Islamic institute for training new Shahadas, new Muslims, and so forth, and also advancing those who had embraced Islam. So he actually supported me, and we extended the Jihadi Institute into Morocco. And there we took students from America, and they resided there in our hostels and so forth, and they learned Islam, and they would come back. What is important about Islam is that not only that the theology benefits you, but we have to understand Islamic culture, you know, the sunnah, how to apply this in our lives as a lifestyle. And when you actually in a culture where you see that, not saying that every culture is perfect in that, but there's enough in the culture that shapes your mind into to agree and to see the reality of Islam in its manifesto. So that was my first experience when I went to Fez, Morocco. And again, I made numerous trips. I returned back to reestablish the institution, and we held our post until 9/11. You know, we had the tragedy, and York, and all foreign institutions were suspended. Unfortunately, we had to break down our camp and come back, and that was a very sad moment for myself and my family. Yes,
I'm sure. Let's come back to North America. You talked about.
Are we still
about,
connected?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Are we still connected?
Can you hear me?
Hello?
I am here. Can you hear
Hello?
Me?
Hello? Are we still connected?
Can you hear me?
It's on his side.
Oh, can we bring him in here? Can you hear me?
We've been having some difficulties here. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Which number is it?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
I hear you very well.
Okay, we're back.
Okay, we were disconnected.
No, it was some difficulty. It was on your side. For some reason, you weren't coming in.
Okay. I don't know what happened.
Can you hear? I can hear him now.
I can hear you now. We
okay.
can hear you. And we apologize to the listening audience. We were discussing, I was going to bring it back to North America during the 20s and the 30s.
Okay.
You left off on 9/11 specifically and how you had to leave the countries and return. So you can finish that up, and then we'll go back into North America.
Yes. We were so integrated in the Moroccan culture and embraced by the people there that, you know, they didn't want us to leave. They tried everything in their power, you know, from a state level to keep our institution going there. But, you know, the powers that be, you know, demanded that all foreign institutions, whether they're in Morocco, Algeria, Egypt, Sudan, whatever, had to break down and come back. And, you know, of course, as you know, everyone had to be reevaluated because of their, you know, being out of the country based on that tragedy that happened. So we actually, we stopped there and we came back, and we never went back to Morocco. I have grandchildren that's still there in Morocco and so forth, but we never returned as an institution. And then we came back, and then my last travels abroad for residency was in Egypt. I went there, and we stayed about 4 years, and I went to study, not to study the Arabic language, because I had reached a level of proficiency, but I went to study how to teach English speakers Arabic language. I went to study the methodology and the science of the language as how to best transmit it into another language or people who were received it as a second language. And we've actually worked in that field with my sons and, you know, and my family, they're still ongoing with their instructions and so forth and so on. I think my son Yusuf, he still instructs Arabic online, which is a very needed science if we want to actually delve deep into, you know, the different meanings of Islamic sciences. So I'm here now back in America, and I've been working with the Bureau of Indigenous Muslim Affairs, doing programs and, you know, talks and so forth and so on. And that's where I'm at right now today, sister.
How beautiful. How beautiful. So we're coming back to North America. And this, you know, to the listening audience, let me just pause here for a few minutes. We're going to have Sheikh Jabir not only this Saturday, but he has graciously extended his time to us for next Saturday as well. And we have time to cover, you know, some things. So next Saturday is going to be January 22nd. You speak, we're not going to start right at this point, but I want to go into the history first. You have several projects going, and one specifically is a project, a documentary, and I would say dedicated to your late father, may Allah be pleased with him, Haj Hashem Jabir.
Amen.
And there's many topics that you address there from a historian perspective.
Mm. Yes.
Specifically, Malcolm X. But before we do that, let's bring it back, because you put us at a very good point in the 1920s and 30s when you started talking about Detroit. Let's bring the Honorable Elijah Muhammad into this sector and how Islam grew from a seed within the Nation of Islam. Risen from that was Malcolm X, later to be known as El-Hajj El-Malik Shabbat. Can we start there?
Yes.
The significance of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Yes, we go back again, you know, we go back to Detroit. When Professor, when Noble Drew Ali organization was dismantled, upon his death, there was a big split. In Detroit, Noble Drew Ali was the centerpiece of Islamic consciousness. As I mentioned earlier, Islam was more philosophical. It was more Eastern in its delivery than a practiced faith as we see it in its full fruition today. And we had a lot of people that were actually taken from that, you know. And one of the people that grew tremendously once the Moorish temple was dismantled or actually split up in different sects was Elijah Muhammad. He came out of that process. He was very aware of that, you know. And I, as I said in the beginning, you know, we are hated before we are loved. And in any time there's a transition, you know, in any ideology or philosophy, we run into opposition. And it was the reason that he left Detroit, Elijah Muhammad left Detroit and went to Chicago. You know, it wasn't like, okay, this is another place to be. But there was some resistance in Detroit. The Moors were so strong that he ran into a lot of opposition, okay? And when he went to Chicago, that's really where he actually began to grow and flourish, okay? Actually had his own autonomy there without a lot of friction from, you know, the Moors and so forth and so on. And as you know, the community itself was gradual. It was more or less Midwest and a Western type influence. It's very, very few members of the Nation of Islam had come to the West. In fact, it was they didn't actually take root in the West, you know, as a pronounced group distinct group until like the late 40s, early 50s, you know, maybe 10 years after the founding of the Nation of Islam as an independent organization that actually all other facets. There was other groups that was attached to that in the beginning. We know about Allah's Temple in Detroit and so forth and so on, and that history. However, upon Haji Malik Shabazz or Malcolm X identifying with the Nation of Islam, it took another level. Actually, the strength of the Nation of Islam actually was an outgrowth, an offshoot of Garveyism, meaning that Garvey, Marcus Garvey, as I mentioned, the first black hero, even though he wasn't from America, he from the Jamaican Islands, he was aware of colonialism that actually was another synonym for Jim Crow oppression or white supremacy in America. So he didn't have to make a lot of adjustments to actually make his point clear. So the Nation of Islam itself picked up that mantle, you know, and not actually calling for Pan-Africanism to return to Africa, but actually creating a separate state, because the Nation of Islam Foundation was that we have rights to this land. You know, this is a piece of us, and not only from the slaves or the ex-slaves and the enslaved, but we have prior existence here. Okay, we are brothers and sisters to the Native Americans here. Many of the Native Americans came to America from our country, from Africa and Asia. So they was well aware of that history. So Elijah Muhammad did not seek to return or go back to Africa, because every person of color in America, as he taught, was not from Africa, you know. So, you know, you just can't take every person of color in America and send them back to Africa. What about those who came from Asia? What about those who came, you know, who was already here? So that brought about the idea of a separate state, which caused a lot of problems for the powers that be. And Malcolm himself, who was introduced to the Nation of Islam by his brother, who was actually who went to Detroit and stumbled upon the Nation of Islam, he was actually looking for a platform that actually resembled the Garvey philosophy, because his orientation from his father, Earl, was actually a follower of Marcus Garvey, and also his mother, Louise. So when he got to Chicago, he saw a hand that could fit into a glove. So he joined the Nation of Islam. He became the secretary and so forth. And Malcolm, as you know, was incarcerated at that time. And he was briefed on the Nation of Islam. And he began to accept the teachings while he was incarcerated. And when he came out for dynamics, he came out with an explosion. And he earned, you know, the respect. You know, he didn't come in looking for, you know, a platform. It was through his dedication and his conviction, you know, and the work that he put in, that he earned that respect, and he earned those the ranking in which Elijah Muhammad gave him. And being that he was in New York, it was a new experience. As I mentioned earlier, that the Nation of Islam had not really taken root on the East Coast as it had in Detroit and Chicago. So with the dynamics of Malcolm and his ability to speak, you know, and to deliver a clear message, not only to the people of high echelons, but also to the grassroots, the numbers began to grow. And actually, I think they grew so fast that we could say it was a phenomenon. It was a phenomenon that began to raise red flags. One thing that is unique about the Nation of Islam and the Malcolm experience is that they was moving in the same direction, you know. And again, a lot of elements got involved in that, you know, from the outside, from the powers that be, that wanted to stop that growth, that consciousness, that awareness, you know. And actually, someone who's reinstilling into you your humanity, you know, because we were a broken people. Mm-hmm. You know, we were a broken people. So someone that had enough gall and enough resilience to stand up against the powers that be, and willing to actually just the statements, if you just look at the very statements that came from his mouth, you know, was a death wish. I mean, no one would tolerate that type of resistance. And we saw how they dealt with our brothers and sisters in the South, Omega Evers, you know, who actually responded to the brutal murder of Emmett Till, you know, a response that caused his death. And then upon the death of Omega Evers, Dr. King responded to that tragedy, you see. And we saw how the South dealt with, you know, people who actually was in defiance to what they considered, what I consider social injustice and human oppression, and they silenced them. So when we saw someone like Haj Malik Shabazz on the soapbox in Harlem, on the TV shows and so forth, actually speaking his mind, representing the Nation of Islam, the credence were there, you know, and people began to gravitate towards that because they saw him relaying a message, you know, that was applicable. You know, and what happened is, like I said, the powers that be from inside and outside got involved. Okay, got involved. And, you know, there's one thing that I've always recognized is that when you are burst inside of an angry society, you know, and Malcolm was angry. I mean, we have to admit that. In fact, he was very angry. But I don't think that his anger matched the injustice, the segregation, the oppression that was being inflicted among people of color. You know, we was all angry, you see what I'm saying? And we had to find platforms, you know, to express that anger, you know, whether it was political, economically, social. We had to actually address the social injustice. So a lot of times people would see Haj Malik Shabazz or Malcolm X deliver what they call a hate speech, but they weren't aware of the climate, of the underworkings of what was going on in the society. You know, Malcolm was twice burnout. You know, he was in an orphanage, you know, a foster home, rather. His father was, as he believed, was murdered by a trolley car, you know. So his mother was put into an insane asylum. I mean, he went through a lot as a child. You know, he went through a lot as a child, and then being incarcerated, and then, you know, living with his sister from the other side, from his father, from a different mother. She tried to give him a sense of direction and some stability, but still that wasn't enough. So Malcolm had to go through the ringer and come out and find a platform that matched, you know, his anger. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's what I call a positive anger. Because he was angry at the right time, he was angry at the right people and at the right circumstances, and he was looking for tools. You know, and if you don't have the patience, and I say this in positive criticism, sometimes you have to be patient. You know, sometimes we want instant results. You know, as the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing be upon him, it took him 23 years of his life to get a victory. You know, to actually secure a victory. And that victory, a bloodless victory in the end, because people who hated him in the beginning have grown to love him. And now we see Haj Malik Shabazz going through that same process, that he ran into a lot of opposition, not only outside of the Nation of Islam, as we know the history, he ran into a lot of opposition inside of the Nation of Islam. And he attempted to work through that, okay? But at the end result of that, his life was taken as a result of that particular conflict. But as we look at the transition of Haj Malik Shabazz, and I did a piece called From Shahada to Shaheed, okay? Mm-hmm. From Shahada to Shaheed. And when and any Muslim, you know, that takes the Shahada, understand there's two parts of it. You know, one of them is the affirmation. The mm-hmm. affirmation is none worthy to be worshipped but Allah. And there's mm-hmm. a negation that you deny all other system, philosophy, ideology that regulates you as a human being, as a lifestyle. So, and this was demonstrated by Imam Wadati Muhammad, when mm-hmm. he made the major, I mean, and a lot of people don't look deep into mm-hmm. Imam Wadati Muhammad's life. He actually put his life on the line. I mean,
he
that was very, very bold position he took. I mean, and sometimes you would wonder how he survived it. You know, really, I mean, to actually boldly stand before a full developed organization, right, and move them you know, into the to a Sunni community. You know, he knew he would gain, but at the same time, he knew he would lose. But he was willing to risk his life, you know. And he brought stability. In fact, he actually was the catalyst. He was the one who stood between the existing, pre-existing Sunni community and the Nation of Islam. He was that meeting point, you see. And a lot of people don't really look at that. I mean, you know, because Allah protected him. I mean, we saw Malcolm was protected, and Allah gave him, you know, as we know, the level of a shaheed, of a martyr. All that you could accomplish in this life, whether it was wealth and fame and glory, was in a nutshell given to him in his death. But Imam Wahdi Muhammad, he survived that whole transition, and you could see the fruits that came out of that. I mean, how many thousands of people took the shahada? You know, and he stayed within the frameworks with patience.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and he looked at the long term. You know, he looked way down the road. You see, and as you see through his patience, that when he came on, and he, it wasn't like he was seeking this position. You know, he wasn't like on the paper as a successor. You see what I'm saying? It was by default.
Mm-hmm.
It was by default, and he himself said he didn't want that position, you know, but he did the right thing. He did the right thing, and as a result, you saw this whole phenomenon break down, and he met with opposition. And as I said, that even though at that moment it appeared that he was doing something contrary, but as we see the results of it, that we're looking at the tree, we're looking at the root, but now it's time to look at the fruit. You see, it's time to look at the fruit. And the tree is still growing. It's still bearing fruit. You see what I'm saying? People are still learning. They're still growing because Islam is generational. It's generation. It took the Quran 23 years for it to be completely revealed. And as we saw, things were being applied, what we call hikmah, at a specific time, you know, when it was necessary for the advancement and growth of those communities. And I think that that's something that we have to look deeper into as the pioneers. How did this transition come about? Because what Malcolm was saying, right, was manifested in Wahdati Muhammad, you know. But he was gravitating towards because I can recall my father was actually a Mutawwif, was a Hajj guide, 300 people who came out of the nation, who came from the Nation of Islam under the leadership of Imam Wahdi Muhammad. And when they made the pilgrimage, it was 300 of them at one time. Could you imagine that?
Wow.
From one community, you see. It was from from Temple 25, Muhammad's Mosque, or Masjid Muhammad, and now Masjid Muhammad Ali, which is Muhammad Ali Muslim, who was on in Newark. It was Imam Ali Muslim and my father who had the first joint Eid.
Mm.
So there you see that unity, that bridging of the gap came smooth. You see, it became smooth. And even today, we have these type of relationships. There's no barriers now. When you go to the masjid, you know, you walk in, you make your prayer, you know the imams and so forth and so on. In fact, when I graduated from the Muhammad bin Saud Islamic Theological Seminary, it was Imam Wahdati Muhammad who reached me my certificate. You know, he was one of the honorary guests there who was actually passing out the certificate and so forth and so on. So just
isn't that outstanding?
Just having that experience, you know. You know, these are growing pains. These are growing pains.
Yes,
and we don't look back. We don't look back, you know, and in the sense, unless it's constructive cynicism, you know, we remember the past so we don't make the mistakes. And we also revise that glory, you know what I'm saying, that came out of that. But again, like I said, Islam itself was something that was practically detested in America. You know, it was something that was restricted. You know, even in the organization that I grew out of, the AAUAA, the Adinulahi University Arabic Association, we had 617 FBI files on that organization in the 30s.
Oh, my goodness.
You see, so why it did not grow? Because there were restrictions. Everyone who became a member was interrogated. They were visited, I'm saying, by the powers that be, law enforcement officers and so forth. They was being intimidated and so forth and so on. So I'm saying this to say that there's always been, you know, an opposition, you know, people that was assigned to stop and restrict the growth of Islam. You see what I'm saying? And you will have to look at the wisdom and the knowledge of those pioneers, those people who were put in places to make a difference. You see, we may have our own personal judgment, or it wasn't done the way we think it should have been done. But you got to look at the results. You got to look at the results. When the prophet was on his way to Mecca and to make the pilgrimage, the Quraysh stopped him and said, "You can't go this year." And they had to write the treaty of Hudaybiyah. And some of the companions was upset because the prophet would not force him to go to Mecca. But he said, "Okay, I agree." But Allah gave him a greater victory. So our limited sight sometimes is not sufficient in judging those people whom Allah has put in charge of our affairs to make sure that we reach our destination.
Yes, sir. You are the author of a book called Call Me Muslim. Give us a little background on that, please.
Yes, Call Me Muslim. I think the subtitle is Going Up in Jim Crow South. Yes, wow. That's my life, the impulses, you know, from that. It will forever be with me. I wrote that book as a sentimental piece. I was in Egypt at the time. I had actually started on a manuscript called The Early Presence of Islam in the New World, and I had taken this book from my father, you know, from his dictates. I would actually write them down. And I was in Egypt, and I was there, and I met some students there from America. And I was talking about personalities like Marcus Garvey, Deuce Ali, you know, Prince Suleiman, Elijah Muhammad, Noble Drew Ali, Lomax Bey. I was just Sheikh Daoud Faisal, Wally Akram, and they had no idea who I was talking about, you know, Lynn Hope. And I was like, you know, y'all are studying Islam. You know, you come here to study the theology of Islam, but you don't know the history. So you're going to return back to America, and you're going to disrespect the pioneers and the institutions and all the work that has been done who laid the – in fact, your being here is a result of the work that was done before you, you know. And I said, you know what? And the brother said to me, I can remember his name, a brother named Eamon. He said, why don't you record this for the younger generation? So I went home, and I started – writing that night, and I pulled my old manuscript up, The Early Presence of Islam in the New World, and as I began to write this book, I found that at least 60-75% of the information I was writing, I was actually there, I knew the people that was doing it, I had some involvement in it. So I changed the direction of my book, and I said, look, let me write an autobiography for my life, okay, and that way I will be, you know, the best in a reference. And I began to write about my life, and I grew up in Jim Crow South. Actually, early part of my life was spent in Jim Crow South. And the unique thing about that is that I had two oppositions. And I was born in 1956. That makes me about 65 years old. I went to segregated schools. I experienced the colored and white water fountains. I experienced sitting in the theater on the top while the whites sit at the bottom and so forth and so on. Climate in which Haj Malik Shabazz was talking about, or what Dr. King was trying to overturn and make it, I was a part of that phenomenon. So I don't consider that history to me. I consider that as a continuum of my experience. So my grandfather was a Baptist minister. Okay, so my father had a religious upbringing, a very disciplinary religious upbringing. As a Muslim in school, you know, as quiet as it kept, you know, I ran into opposition from people of color, okay, because of the fact that my religion or my orientation was different, you know, and the misinformation or just outright ignorance at that time, they viewed Islam as a heathen faith. They actually equated it to something like African paganism, you see? So I ran into a lot of odds with people, you know, on the religious tip that looked just like me. And when we integrated the schools, which was a phenomenon, a very, very deep experience, I was a person of color, and I had a different faith. So it was double jeopardy against me, you know. And my father was at that particular time was deep involved in the social revolution. He was, you know, in the riots and all of this stuff going on in the North and so forth. In fact, we were kept in the South as a state so that we wouldn't actually be victimized or become, you know, casualties because, you know, everything was happening in the 60s, you know, with people on the front line. So he protected us on our grandparents' farm. But I grew up in that manner, and I wrote the book to kind of like inspire young Muslims, at you know, encouraging them and instilling in them that if you have a strong enough will to be who you are, then you can overcome and you can survive, you know, America as a Muslim. You see, you don't have to compromise. And then moving from North Carolina into New York in the 70s, I'm talking about the heroin epidemic. Okay. And as a student going to high school, I mean, I had never in my life saw any form of narcotics in its raw form, just pictures. But when I got into New York, I actually saw students, man, like middle school, you know, actually involved in drugs, you know, high school in drugs. And, you know, just the society itself was so enticing and so compelling that, you know, if you didn't have a foundation, you know, a strong conviction, then you would have been, you know, pulled into that like driftwood. So my Islam growing up as a youngster in Jim Crow South was challenging. My experience in New York, New Jersey was a challenge trying to repel all the negative influences that was coming at me and so forth. And fortunately, I actually married when I was 19 years old. You know, I got married when I was 19 years old, and I have 13 children. I have 20-some-odd grandchildren, mashallah, alhamdulillah. But that book was written to inspire young Muslims who may be running into challenges and so forth and so on. And what happened is that when I say, oh, I got married at 19, that's unthinkable nowadays. You know, young men are getting married at 30, 40 years old because – the maturity level is so slow now.
At
16, I can recall when I went to my father, I think it was about maybe 16 years old, and I asked him for an allowance, you know, to increase my allowance. I can't recall. And he reached me a product because we were merchants. He said, this is your allowance from henceforth. And he was actually giving me, you know, the incentive to look, you have to become a man. You know, you have to become, and I look at that experience, and I was like, wow, it was a benefit, even though I didn't agree with that at a particular time. But, you know, he gave us an opportunity to be men, to challenge the society. And a lot of that went into my book, and I try to help young people, you know, navigate. Because, you know, the times we're in, this is a very difficult times, and our youth are at risk. We have so much coming at them, you know, and we had a lot coming at us. And I applaud all the Muslims that I see finishing the race. I applaud them because I know what they had to go through. I know their challenges, especially those who reverted to Islam, who left lifestyles. You know, sometimes it was to the extent that it caused families to split. So I applaud Muslims who actually finished the race. And I call on the youth, the generations to come, you know, to try to finish the race, you know, and we have a rich history, you know, and a lot of people have did a lot of work, and we have to look at the end results, you know. We can't look at the immediate because, you know, if we look at the immediate, we're going to find criticism, you know, and that is what we call negative criticism, and it will cause us to close the book. You know, and one of the things that is unique is that when we talk about Malcolm, and we talk about his life, you know, and a lot of people say, you know, I learned about Malcolm through Alex Haley books. You know, I learned it through, you know, the autobiography of Malcolm. I said, yeah, that's one stage of his life, okay? And one person said, well, I learned about Malcolm through his lectures on the internet. I said, that's one stage of his life. But you have to look at his shahada. You have to look at his pilgrimage. Because, you know, my father, Haji Sham Jabba, and when we say Hajj, and why did they, today, you know, we don't see people carrying the title Hajj. I mean, I've made Hajj 13 times, but I don't use the term Hajj Muhammad Jabbar. But at that particular time, to carry the title of Hajj was like a second shahada. It was actually saying that you had made the transition to orthodoxy Islam, and you were privy to visit the holy city of Mecca. You see, so that Hajj a second shahada, and that's why when a person would come up, it's just like saying, "Well, I'm Dr. So and so, so and so." You're carrying an honorary title on your name because of a accomplishment. So we looked at it in that manner. So that's why I say that Malcolm is a transforming personality. Actually, he's a phenomenon, and everybody is taken from him. You know, we didn't have a black power struggle or a black nationalist movement until his assassination or his death. Then all of these people who grasped parts of Malcolm began to structure their own ideology and philosophy around bits and pieces of his life, not looking at the full phenomenon. You see, so we are there. We are there. Anyone who said, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, Ashhadu anna Muhammadur Rasulullah, we are there. So we are the inheritors of Malcolm. You see what I'm saying? In fact, Malcolm reached the point that he joined 1.2 billion, 1.8 billion now Muslims. So we have the biggest family on the planet. You see what I'm saying? So I tried to put those things inside of my book to let people know that has occurred in real time. And Islam is an application. And we have to practice Islam like a doctor or a physician practice medicine with precision.
Mm. So beautifully put, and you covered all points. Oh, what a foundation you're providing. This is such a treat. So in the book, and we'll go into more of this next week. Oh, looking so forward to it, so excited. From Malcolm X to El Hajj El Malik Shabazz, you're going to go into more of that next week.
Yes, I would love to.
Let's talk about your dad for a minute.
Wow.
The late Hajj Hashem Jabir. Let's talk about him for a minute. He actually performed the final funeral rites of Malcolm X.
Yes. You know, my father, El Haji Sham Jabir, you know, I call him Sheikh. You know, I call him my Sheikh because
yes, sir.
I was his student, you know, as a child, you know, and he was more of a teacher and an inspiration and a guide, and I would see that father in him at moments in his downtime, you know. It's a very, very weird feeling, you know, that you know, even though that's my father, but my views of him was of honor, and I would cherish those moments in his downtime when he would just rub me on the head and say, "What's on your mind, son?" Or we would just go get a ice cream pop from the store, or just have some just general discussion, you know, family talk. Because he was so involved in the social revolution that it absorbed him. When he come home, he would tell us what he experienced through the day. He would tell us about his future plans. He would tell us what was going on in the real world. And we appreciated that. He had us in front of the United Nations, Palestine for the Palestinian people in the early 70s. We was all over the place running all through the United Nations building, being, you know, accosted by the security and thrown out and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, when they say your father, Hisham Jabba, I have to pause a moment and look for daddy in that man because of what he brought to me on the outside. And it was a full package. And, you know, when he did the janaza, the final burial rite for Malcolm, you know, and every time he would tell that story, he would tell it with intensity. You know, it was not a joking matter for him because, you know, his life was actually threatened as well. You know, and the history, you know, is the proof of that. That when it came down to actually performing the janaza or the funeral, a lot of calls went out. You know, calling people who actually we saw, you know, in the photo ops. You know, I mean, the people that you saw standing with Malcolm, the people you saw, you know, interviewing Malcolm, the people, you know, that was around Malcolm. But when it came to actually fulfill his last rites in which he held over the Muslim, these people were invisible.
Mm.
They were nowhere to be found, okay? And as Ahmed Uthman said, the one who actually did the eulogy, which actually didn't appear in Spike Lee movie, okay, and that's a problem, okay? Mm. And we're going to address that in I Buried Malcolm, okay, which is positive criticism as well, okay? But he said that no one came. And he said when Haji Sham Jabba walked in, it took a burden off them because if, in fact, my father had not championed that task, then perhaps we would have lost Malcolm into the obscurities of black nationalism. Maybe he would have went down in history as a bigot, as a hate monger. You know, maybe we would have lost him as a Muslim. Okay, so when my father, if you notice in the photos when Malcolm is held in state, that he has on a Western suit, and then the second picture you see him in the shroud. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen like the waving of a wand. That was a process. That was a strong negotiation to be able to take him from the suit, to give him the wash and the shrouding according to the Islamic traditions. That was a process. Mm-hmm. That wasn't as a waving of a wand. A lot of people miss that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
My father, when he came in, if you notice, when he's standing in that picture in front of the coffin, there's only one person standing beside him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? One person standing beside him. Now, his security was scattered in the audience, because he just knew that he would actually be faced with some conflict at that point. And he was intent, okay?
Mm.
He you know. And not only that, he had a wife.
He had children.
So he had put everything on the line, okay, for just to give him his rights. What happened is that Haj Malik Shabazz's transition when he went to Mecca and coming back was so rapid that a lot of the Muslims that were in New York at that particular time, like the Dar, it was called Dar Islam Movement, and we had Sheikh Dawood Faisal from the American Muslim Mission on State Street, they had not recognized fully Malcolm in his transition. So there was standoff. You understand what I'm saying? Because Malcolm was so dynamic and prolific in his delivery when he was with the Nation of Islam that they could not match him, you know, in any type of a debate. You see what I'm saying? They could not subdue him. So they had this standoff, okay? But as time unfolded, they began to love him. As they began to really go back and read his memoirs and his letters and his experience, I mean, it's so inspiring, you know? So my father took that chance to do that, you know. And if you notice, I don't know if you ever saw the clipping, he's saying, Labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, labbaik, la sharika labbaik, innal hamda wa ni'mata laka wal mulk la sharika lak. This is the Hajj cry. This is the Hajj cry. And my father was Hajj himself at that time, and he was acknowledging the pilgrimage of Hajj Malik Shabazz
throughout that period of them transporting him to the gravesite, and that phenomenon, if we understood the significance of Hajj at that particular time, and he's standing in the, and you see he got the white cloth over his head and so forth, and at that time he was the president of the AAUAA, and my father was only 34 years old at that time. He was not an old man, okay, and Hajj Malik Shabazz was only 39. So we're talking about our youth.
Yes.
Okay. We're talking about our youth on the front lines, and it linked them for a lifetime. I mean, it's like by him performing, even though he had, you know, met Hajj Malik Shabazz informally in the mosque and so forth, in talks and stuff like that, but answering Malcolm's last rites, performing his last rites, connected them. To the point that when his wife, Betty, was burned and near death, that he requested him to come to the hospital. And he led her in prayer, and she followed him with her finger. She followed because she was burned so bad. And every year, my father would go to Boston and to visit his sister Ella Collins, and he would speak there about Hajj Malik Shabazz and so forth and so on. And my older brother, Imam Ali, would accompany him in many cases, and he would sleep in Malcolm's bed, you know. He would sleep in Malcolm's bed, and we would talk about that. I said, how did it feel sleeping in Malcolm's bed? He said, I was scared all night. I didn't sleep. I just lie in it, you know. So
wow.
So I just lied. I didn't sleep. But I asked my father, you know, why is it that you go to Boston every year? You know, and you commemorate, you know, the life of Hajj Malik Shabazz. You know, this is something that's kind of like not really traditional, but he said to me, you know, I do this because I want to make sure that Malcolm is not buried as a black nationalist. I like to speak to the audience as they come about his Islam and show them how Islam impacts a person's life who's seeking justice. And not only that, we see that a lot of the profound people that have made a difference in our culture, in our society, have identified with the Islamic paradigm or has respected the Islamic paradigm to the point that there's no opposition in the flow of us trying to seek and accomplish social justice and equality. So that was my father's life in a nutshell. And not only that, and we'll talk about his journey after that, you know, because what Malcolm was seeking to accomplish, you know, a lot of that continued, but not in the name of Malcolm. You know, his sister Ella Collins, who actually was responsible for the scholarships that was allotted to him for those people who to go travel abroad, and a lot of the recipients of those scholarships, right, are people that we don't know. We don't know who they are because history, the pen of the historians have failed to actually record them. And this is something very important. You know, who know about Akbar Muhammad, you know, who spent a decade plus in Egypt, El Azhar, you know. I mean, I was actually a student with Malcolm's brother, you know. We sat in close proximity, had, you know, intimate discussions about his life, their life, and Malcolm's life. You see, a lot of these things are not inserted in our narrative system that needs to be there so that we can see the full picture. So my father did take a challenge. He risked his life. As I mentioned, people don't look at that. As I mentioned, Imam Wadi Muhammad, he actually risked all he had to take that nation of Islam into a transition, to join them with the Sunni community. That was a tremendous task, and that took a lot of courage. I don't even know if it's courage. I don't even know if you have enough courage. I don't even call it courage.
Faith, yes.
I call it
that faith of a mustard seed.
Yes.
That's all.
It supersedes
we're at.
Courage.
Yes.
It supersedes courage.
Beautifully put.
Yeah.
Beautifully
yes.
put. If the listening audience, and we're going to certainly address more of this next week. You have a documentary called I Buried Malcolm documentary. The final chapter, The Legacy of Hajj Hisham Jabir, a never told before story. We look so forward to this legacy, to this history. for the listening audience, how may they purchase your book and how you have a GoFundMe page on a Buried Malcolm documentary. I want to mention that this week, we'll do that again next week. If you can tell us how we can get the book and access the documentary.
Okay. The book, I Buried Malcolm, is actually sold out, and we are actually doing a reprint on it with some additional chapters in it. So hopefully in June, the book will be available again, I Buried Malcolm. What happened was my father wrote this book. Actually, I encouraged him to write the book because he just told me so much about the life of Malcolm and his experience. And I said, you know, Sheikh, if you pass away, you know, I'm the only one going to have this information. The family's the only one going to have this information. So will you please write this down? And he sat at the table and he started writing the book. And he finished it, and it was just actually intense outline, like a template of what actually transpired in his experience with actually Barry and Malcolm. And that's the book that is in demand right now. We're going to try to bring it back within 4 months, inshallah. The movie itself, or the documentary, I like to say, and it's not a docudrama. It's not something to entertain. It's something to edutain, okay, to bring people into the reality of the continuum of Islam, you know, Malcolm after the grave, you know, Malcolm after the grave. What happened, you know, like I mentioned, the conversion of the NOI into the Sunni community through Imam Wahdatuddin Muhammad. What happened after Malcolm? You know, the life and legacy of Haji Sham Jabba, the man who actually risked his life to bury him, who's actually casted in all the photos, you know, the Ebony Black History Encyclopedia. In the movie, but the name is never mentioned.
Ooh.
You know, why the name is never mentioned of something, which is actually one of the Islamic principles of giving a person the proper janazah. What is a janazah? And the idea of a martyr, why this person's name is never mentioned in all of the photos, all of the newspaper, all of the films, clippings, why his name is not mentioned. You know, and that's because, as I mentioned earlier, the AAUAA, the Adinu Alahi University Arabic Association, has 617 unclassified FBI files. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So it speaks for itself. But what did Haji Sham Jabba do? Why was he the national imam for the oldest indigenous Muslim organization in America? And his travels. In the Islamic Press International, he was the attaché for press attaché for the Muslim World League. He worked for the Muslim World League, the one who gave Haj Malik Shabazz the scholarships, okay, for 20 years. And he traveled into over 40 Muslim countries. He was in South Africa on Randers Island when Nelson Mandela was incarcerated there. 200 shahadas to the Zulu people, okay, and just, you know, his works. You know, as a da'i, and how many people have come to Islam by way of him? How many shahadas he have given? Established the Adinullahi University Arabic Institute, Jihad Institute. He had a satellite institution in Morocco. He founded the Dawah College. There's so many things that's actually still going on. In fact, the Bureau of Indigenous Muslim Affairs was the last organization he established for the purpose of addressing our needs as indigenous Muslims, as we interact, you know, with the government from a political, social, and economic level on this turf in America, to make sure that we have the proper recognition as free-born citizens in this society. So there's a lot that we want to say in this movie as a continuation. And I think that we owe that to the up-and-coming generations. And that's why we're doing the movie. And we are actually, you know, want people to be involved. If not historically sharing their information, financially, they can support it. All they have to do is go to GoFundMe, type in I Buried Malcolm documentary, and make a contribution. I Buried Malcolm documentary in the GoFundMe. And actually, we're doing this not as an economic adventure, but as a dawah piece, as something that we can bring to the public, you know, not about all the the difficulties and the conflict that we've outgrown. We are far beyond that. Okay, we're on the same platform. But to demonstrate that through growing pains, you know, through sacrifice, you know, self-sacrifice as well, and struggle, that we will actually accomplish that which we have set out to. And that is an ultimate victory, inshallah.
Inshallah, yes, thank you. Oh, what an absolute pleasure, a blessing for you to be here today. Now, what about the book, Color Me Muslim? Is there a way we can get that book?
Yes, what I'm going to do, my son, he handles my byproducts. He does have, you can go to the Color Me Muslim website, Color Me Muslim website, and you will find those byproducts on there. And that book, according to my knowledge, can be purchased from that particular website, Color Me Muslim, yes.
Excellent. Sheikh Muhammad Jabir, this platform that you are taking time out of your busy schedule to give us, it's historical in itself. The information that you're sharing, that you're covering, the continuation of the importance of us to work as a unified community. We thank you here at Family Life, and we look so forward to having you on next week again. Thank you to the listening audience. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent. Rod Speaks. Thank you for joining us today. If you would like to reach me, you may do so at Salima, S-A-L-I-M-A-H-M-O-H, 77 at gmail.com. And is there, we gave the different sites to get the information on a product. Is there an email address that individuals can reach you?
Yes. The email address is bima@gmail.com. That's B-I-M-A, bima@gmail.com.
Excellent. Thank you. We look forward to seeing you next week. To the listening audience, we give you the greetings of Assalamu Alaikum. Have a wonderful day.
Wa Alaikum Salam. And I would like to thank New Africa Excellence for inviting me, Muhammad Murad Speaks, for inviting me, and may Allah continue to grant you success in your endeavors to get information out in a timely manner. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum as-salam. Thank you.